This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
Real life is scarier than anything we can dream of, and we dream such frightening things. Sci-fi and Scream.
Be afraid.
Be very afraid. On Joy 94.9. Joy.
And you're listening to Sci-Fi and Scream. We are on Joy 94.9. Thanks for joining Sonia and Kaz. And we are wrapping up our Tim Burton special this week. Up until October, there's a Tim Burton exhibition running at the ACMI, Australian Centre for the Moving Image, exhibition in Melbourne. And Sonia, we've been along to that. We went along to that last week.
Yeah, it was fantastic, actually.
It was really fantastic. Good. And we've actually posted some photos from that day up on our Facebook page now.
Yeah.
So technology's taking its time, but they're finally up there. And we've got a couple of interviews for you tonight just to wrap up our Tim Burton special.
Here on Australia's only LGBTIQ horror and sci-fi show on the radio waves that we know of anyway, on Joy 94.9. And just a quick thanks to David and Jade, who did everything different with different strokes. So what have we got on tonight's show?
We're going to speak to, well, we have spoken to, we're going to play the interview that we had with Jenny Hee, who is one of the curators of the Tim Burton exhibition. She's come all the way from MoMA in New York to make sure that it was set up and very well hung at the ACMI. And we're also going to speak to Roberta Chiabara, and you spoke to Roberta.
Yes, Sonia. She's also from ACME, whereas obviously Jenny's from MoMA. But Roberta is curating the series of films called Monsters, Ghouls and Melancholy Misfits, which is sort of playing around at the same time.
That's right.
Starting soon.
And so looking at Tim Burton, last week we looked at Tim Burton's films and we reviewed a couple of our favourites. We also gave you a quick rundown on what was going to be covered in the exhibition. As I mentioned, the exhibition is running till October 2010 and we urge you all to get out there and have a look. It's fantastic for Tim Burton fans and for anyone who's just interested in his films or maybe his influences. Now, Tim Burton was obviously influenced a lot by sort of Hammer horror films and the work of Vincent Price.
You're listening to Sonia and Kaz on Joy 94.9 on Sci-Fi and Scream, and we're going to be listening to that interview, the first part of the interview, with Jenny Hee from MoMA. Welcome to Sci-Fi and Scream. I'm Sonia and I'm joined with Kaz here, and we're at the Tim Burton media opening at the exhibition here at ACME, and I have a special guest I'm going to have a quick chat to, and that is Jenny Hee, and she's from MoMA. Welcome to Sci-Fi and Scream, Jenny.
Oh, thank you for having me.
That's great. So you only arrived on Sunday.
Yes, and I've been at ACME almost every single day, so I haven't had a chance to see Greater Melbourne yet, but what I've seen has been great.
Jenny, what prompted an exhibition on the work of Tim Burton?
Oh, well, the Museum of Modern Art has been hosting gallery exhibitions on filmmakers since 1939, when the Film Library was founded, now the Department of Film. Our first exhibition was on Georges Méliès, of course, the film pioneer. And then most recently, we had an exhibition on Pixar, the animation studio, which ACME also hosted.
Okay.
And, of course, Tim Burton was certainly a no-brainer. We knew that he had a wealth of drawings and paintings based on sort of scant evidence that we've seen published on the release of his films. And so we started on the premise that we would explore Tim Burton's process as a filmmaker. And then as we did more and more research and visited his archive, as well as the archive of private collectors and studios, we realized that there was a whole unseen Burton that existed. And of course, you see it in this exhibition, a great number of unrealized projects that Tim developed while he was an apprentice animator at Disney in the early 80s. Now, these projects were never made into films, but they certainly lay the foundation for his later work, and certainly that's where he honed his signature style and his recurring motifs that everyone is now familiar with, of course, the balance of horror and humor,
yeah,
the dichotomy between children and adults, and then of course, his motifs that you see all around you, stripes, spirals, the carnivalesque.
Very carnivalesque and circus. like
atmosphere. Yes, I love what, how Acme has transformed our exhibition. Of course, the Burtonarium is,
I can't wait to see that.
Big Fish, Batman Returns. So it's great how they integrated Tim's filmmaking aesthetic into this exhibition.
Absolutely. Excellent.
Now, they mentioned it was a bit of an archaeological dig to get all of this information. How did you contact collectors? How did you find out where all of this great exhibition stuff was?
Well, it was a bit of a bit of detective work. I have to say, if I left curating, I could go into private investigation. But I have to say that the turning point was, of course, Tim allowing us into his private archive. And it's from his private archive that we started building this exhibition. Everything from collaborators augment and complement his work. But we basically, of course, we knew studio archivists and certainly a lot of private auctions. We knew a lot of the props and films went to private collectors. So we basically just really did a lot of kind of detective work and archaeological dig, as you say.
Sci-Fi and Scream with Sonia and Kaz, and it was Jenny Hay from MoMA. That's the first part of that interview we had last week on the 23rd.
That's right, and in it, Jenny talks about different themes that are in Tim Burton's work, various dichotomies she mentioned, like children and adults, which is a kind of a recurring theme in his film, really. If you go back to his earliest work, which is Pee-wee Herman's Big Adventure, or Pee-wee's Big Adventure, I should say, Pee-wee, played by Paul Reubens, is obviously a very childlike character who is forced into dealing with, you know, certain things that that adults have to deal with in everyday life. He goes on this kind of quest, and he becomes, I suppose, a bit of an adult through that. And those sorts of personal themes and motifs of coming of age are in lots of Tim Burton films, particularly, I suppose, I'm thinking of Edward Scissorhands, which is, you can actually see Edward's suit at the Acme exhibitions.
Oh, that was
really
fantastic. Yeah. Very gothic.
Very gothic. Well, yeah, his influences are very gothic. You mentioned The Raven by Edgar Allan Poe. I think Edgar Allan Poe's themes are fairly prevalent throughout Tim Burton's work.
Very much so. And, of course, on our Facebook, we did put an article there that Tim Burton loves the fact that Melbourne's so dark.
I can kind of agree with him there, because when I was taking photos, if you look, go on our Facebook page, just search for Sci-Fi and Scream, you'll see some of the photos we took, particularly of the red carpet event that was held in Tim Burton's honour. They've really decked out Acme in Tim Burton, I suppose, style. So the Acme lighted sign is black and white now, and they've got like a serpent snake head coming out of the...
From Nightmare Before Christmas.
Yeah, the Nightmare Before Christmas style. Very much so. And, I mean, Melbourne with its kind of dark alleys, and if you've ever done, say, for instance, a ghost tour of Melbourne or a historical tour of Melbourne, you do get a real sense. So, for instance, on Little Lonsdale Street, they've got where, you know, where the prostitutes used to ply their wares, and the old morgue... on Little Lonsdale Street as well. You just get this real kind of gothic sense, even though it's sort of removed from the gothic time, I suppose, and place. It doesn't surprise me that it's gelled really well with Melbourne.
Well, apparently he loved the fact there were some steampunk people there dressed in their finery and corsets, and he was very impressed.
Yeah, and there was actually, Sonia and I spotted, they had a greeter at the red carpet event.
Yes, it was a lady.
A lady. Lovely lady in a corset and very high heels.
And suspenders.
And she had a rabbit, a white rabbit as well.
A real one.
A real one. Yeah.
It was a real one. It was looking a bit twitchy.
It was a little bit. Well, with all those flashing cameras.
But it was in a top hat, so it must have been a special breed of magician's rabbit, I feel.
It was. And so they had a special red carpet event. But for anyone who wants to go and see the exhibition, you can go and check it out. And as Jenny Hay mentioned in that first part of the interview, there's lots of really interesting stuff to see.
There is. We'll be playing more of that in a moment. You're listening to Sonia and Kaz on Joy 94.9.
You mentioned that Tim Burton was a no-brainer.
Yes.
How would you decide otherwise that a director's work is prolific enough to warrant an exhibition?
Well, we have a large curatorial team in the film department at MoMA. And, of course, we all have our special niches. And for Tim, starting from Pee-wee's Big Adventure and viewing the trajectory of his feature film work, you sort of see an alterist vein. Of course, if Tim was right beside me, he would certainly, I suppose, put up a fight and an argument against that. But you do see, not only in his filmmaking, but also in his artwork, themes and motifs that are so personal to him, that they recur, not consciously or not on purpose, but perhaps even subconsciously. And I think it's that emotional connection that Tim has with his characters and his themes that allow it to resonate to such a universal audience. And that is why so many people have connected with his characters and his works.
Mm. Absolutely. Well, I definitely saw it in Alice in Wonderland.
Yes.
I noticed that it had just come through and distilled.
Yes. And of course, Kate Warren, the curator here, wrote a great essay for the catalog about Tim and fairy tales and fables and his adaptations. And of course, you know, Tim loves taking tried and true known entities. Here we're standing for Nightmare Before Christmas is, of course, a play on the Clement Clark Moore poem, taking what is known and what is familiar and sort of turning it on its head. And I think that is at the core of Tim's work, just taking what is expected and showing you a side that is unexpected. So he grew up loving monsters such as Frankenstein's monster, the stop-motion animated monsters in Ray Harryhausen's works. And those are, to him, are the sympathetic characters in those stories. And that's why, you know, you see that in Tim's work as well, his ability to kind of connect with the characters on the fringe and allow you to see a side that perhaps hasn't been known before.
So, I mean, that obviously, looking at all of these exhibition items helps us to understand that side of Tim Burton's filmmaking.
Yes.
Do you think that with the way films are made now, quite often there'll be a script or a remake and there doesn't seem to be a lot of love put into it? Do you think this helps give us a greater understanding of filmmaking and good filmmaking?
Hopefully. I think that, Tim certainly did not set out to be a filmmaker to kind of transform, you know, film canons or anything like that. But I think, you know, the happenstance of creating a work that he himself is personally attached to allows us to view certain stories in a different way. Charlie in the Chocolate Factory, of course, has a father figure. Ichabod Crane has, you know, a mother figure. So there's sort of this taking a character that's well known and then digging deeper and taking, you know, what Tim himself is connected to and finding something new.
Yeah.
They mentioned, obviously, we've already had a bit of a joke about it, that this has been called a mid-career retrospective.
Yes, yes.
So Tim's still got a long way to go. Where do you see, as sort of a fan and also as a curator, where do you see Tim's work going from here?
I think he will continue to surprise us. I think seeing Sweeney Todd, of course, in 2007, which is an adaptation of the Sondheim musical, and, you know, there's a joke going around that that's Tim's romantic comedy. So seeing sort of this kind of very grotesque Grand Guignol horror transformed into this kind of, I wouldn't say lighthearted, but certainly not as dark as you would expect that musical to be adapted into. And then seeing Tim tackle the musical genre head on is certainly a transformation. And then Alice in Wonderland, of course, is 3D. That's Tim's first time working so extensively with green screen. So I think that, you know, that we can expect much more from Tim.
Innovation, I think.
Exactly.
One of the big words that come into his work. You know?
Exactly. And, you know, Tim loves kind of the tactileness of directing. And so, you know, he worked a green screen, and perhaps in the next film, he'll be able to transform the green screen experience into his way of directing. Of course, you know, stop motion animation will forever be, will have a soft spot in Tim's heart. So I think seeing that transform would be very interesting.
You seem to have a soft spot for stop animation, and looking at your bio online at the MoMA site, what would be your favorite one of Burton's?
Oh, I would have to say Nightmare Before Christmas.
Yeah.
Right. I'm of that generation where I grew up seeing this as the first stop-motion animated film that was contemporary to my time. So that actually made me go back and want to explore the work of Willis O'Brien or Ray Harryhausen or Jim Danforth. And I think that's what Tim does. He has his childhood idols, and he causes, you know, he allows other people to dig back into film history.
Sci-Fi and Scream, Sci-Fi and Horror News for the show tonight, Wednesday the 30th of June 2010. Now some of the latest, well, up to today anyway. Now, do you believe that people can have a soulmate, Kaz?
Absolutely not.
Okay. Well, I'll cross out the next bit out here. Because if you did, well, then maybe this is the film for you. News from scifimafia.com is that Channing Tatum, from G.I. Joe, The Rise of Cobra, is reportedly attached to star in a new sci-fi film entitled Ion. The film will be produced by Tony Scott and Ridley Scott. 20th Century Fox's 2000 label is likely to pick up the script written by Will Dunn. Now, that's reported on Ion, and Ion apparently is a sci-fi romantic epic. The story revolves around a man who travels throughout the different Earths in the universe to try and find his lover who has been reincarnated. The script has been compared to James Cameron's Avatar in terms of its scope and fantasy elements. Well, we'll see if it breaks the box office records like Avatar, and as yet there's no production date that's been finalised. Now, looking at horror on the little screen, HBO's True Blood series has another Kiwi joining its flock, or should I say pack, wolf pack that is. Kiwi actor Grant Bowler plays the leader of a certain pack of wolves, werewolves, working for the Vampire King of Mississippi. Now, some of you out there may remember Bowler from the New Zealand TV drama series Outrageous Fortune, and he's also appeared on American TV show Ugly Betty. Now, according to SciFiMafiaAgain.com, the actor says his character, Cooter, is a joy to play. I play a very strong agenda. They're not just kicking around looking for someone to beat on. And saying that also, right from the beginning, I felt like Alan Ball, was writing a comedy, like the world's darkest comedy, and I love it. I'm sure Grant will add something special to the role in the series that is still not available on free-to-air here. That's a pity. And since we're talking pretty much everything about Tim Burton tonight, there is the rumour of a new 3D Addams Family movie, first mentioned earlier this year, and apparently it's moving forward, but is still in its very early stages. It's all very, very early, apparently, but we are developing it with Tim Burton directing in mind. We're just now at the story phase. Stuff has been written as though we are doing it in black and white, but that's not correct. It's not incorrect either, but it's not correct. And we haven't got to that point, says Melon Dandry, and that is Christopher Melon Dandry, who made Despicable Me, the producer of that film. That's taken from darkhorizonswebsite.com. And apparently they plan to use 3D stop motion as a technique. It will be more based upon the Charles Addams comics that appeared in the New Yorker magazine during the 50s and 60s, which inspired the TV sitcom. And finally, in superhero news, with the X-Men prequel set to be in production this August, some key characters have been cast already. We're just starting to see producer Bryan Singer and director Matthew Vaughn, who did Kick-Ass, fill the ranks of the X-Men First Class roster. The latest character about to be confirmed is that of Emma Frost, aka the White Queen, who once fought against the X-Men but later joined them. Emma Frost is a main character in the current X-Men comics, and she's also in X-Men Origins. The latest rumour is that Emma Frost will be perhaps played by Rosamund Pike, British actress, although this has raised some eyebrows due to her age being 31. Now, Emma Frost, along with the other X-Men team members, are meant to be in their late teenage years, as in the Wolverine flick. Frost was depicted as being the same or of similar age as Cyclops. Luckily, British actress Rosamund Pike was later reported to be playing the character of Moira MacTaggert, a scientist and early love interest of Professor X. But it now looks likely that it's maybe Alice Eve, who is the latest candidate for the lead female role in the Marvel Studios. Our first Avenger, Captain America, and she may be playing Emma Frost in the X-Men First Class. She's 28, so she's only a few years younger than Pike, but apparently has more of the look that they're looking for. What do you think about that?
She. When I first saw the photo of her, she did strike me a little bit as the White Queen. She's kind of got the square jaw that I think of when I think Emma Frost.
Yeah, definitely.
And look, nobody's going to be looking at her face if she's going to wear the classic Emma Frost outfit, which I'm sure loads of people are looking forward to seeing.
Certain blokes and some ladies, maybe. Yes. So that's she'll be joining the cast, which sounds pretty exciting, of James McAvoy as Professor X, Ben Walker as Beast, and a new, most recent addition, Michael Fassbender, will be playing Magneto.
Magneto, I think he'll be playing.
Okay. Yeah,
he does wear kind of magenta-coloured clothes, yeah, but Michael Fassbender, can I just say, is fantastic. I mean, I watched him from his early role in Hex, which was not a very successful or popular TV show. He's just come...
And he was in that Stephen McQueen film. about the IRA, which was fabulous. Yeah, I can't remember the name of it.
It's not called Hunger, something like that. Is it Hunger?
Yes. Hunger. Wonderful. And, of course, Inglourious Basterds, Quentin Tarantino's film.
He was fabulous in that. Yeah, some really interesting news there. I doubt Ion will make as much money as Avatar, to be honest.
No. Well, you won't be seeing it.
I quite like Channing Tatum, so I probably will be. But I just don't
the
see
story,
it. It sounded a little bit like The Fountain, actually. It reminded me of that Darren Aronofsky.
That was a sad film.
Yeah.
Literally. I mean, I'm always one. You've been listening to the horror and sci-fi news on Sci-Fi and Scream on Joy 94.9. Sci-Fi and Scream.
On Joy 94.9, you're listening to Sonia and Kaz tonight, and we are talking about Tim Burton. We're just wrapping up the specials that we've had over the last couple of weeks. Sonia and I were lucky enough to go and see the exhibition last week. We are going to have an interview with Roberta Chiabara. Now, you spoke to Roberta.
Yeah, it was done a couple of weeks ago, mind you, but it was excellent to see her there at the exhibition that evening when we went. It's basically her talking about her, curating the monsters, ghouls and melancholy misfits, and we just chat too about some of her favourite Burton films and pieces. You're listening to Sonia and Kaz on Joy 94.9. Welcome to Sci-Fi and Scream, Australia's only LGBTIQ horror and science fiction radio show on Joy 94.9. And I would like to welcome Roberta Chiabara, the curator of a very special Tim Burton film season at the Acme in Melbourne City this winter as part of the Tim Burton exhibition that's on tour at present. Now, it's called Monsters, Ghouls and Melancholy Misfits. What can you tell us about that? What is it about, Roberta?
Monsters, Ghouls and Melancholy Misfits is a thematic film program that we've put together that basically seeks to present a group of films that share certain traits. Some of them are films that Tim Burton has quoted as being just films that he loved growing up. Others, you can actually sort of tease out some stylistic influences that you can see in Burton's work as a filmmaker. And a few others are just films that share a sort of sensibility that, you know, we might sort of refer to as Burton-esque. So we've sought to bring together different genres and elements that Burton, you know, quite loves. So things like the classic monster movies that Universal Studios became famous for in the 1930s.
Yeah, like you've got Frankenstein, Dracula, both 1931. It's quite interesting.
That's right, yeah. I think Universal Studios just went really hard once they'd sort of hit on this little, you know, collection of monsters and they started doing well, they just churned them out and, you know, with the Frankenstein series thing, and they had Bride of and Son of and on it went.
Versus the Wolfman and so
on. Yeah, Abbott and Costello came in at some point. And, the original ones, and as well as those, some of the British Hammer horror productions you can sort of, I guess, pick up in films like Sleepy Hollow, which was a sort of a concerted attempt by Burton to bring in some of those influences.
Very much so. Now, what's your role in that in the screenings of these films?
Oh, okay. I'm one of the film programmers. There's three dedicated full-time film programmers in the film programs unit at ACME. So I guess curated the season, but we did want to make sure that, Tim Burton approved of our selection and that we hadn't gone out on a limb in saying that something was, you know, a stylistic influence or a favourite film. So we ran the program selection by him and got a very encouraging email back saying, you know, all approved,
excellent.
Great selection, you know, happy to endorse it. So we got the tick of approval from Mr. Burton.
Yeah, great. It's a fascinating mix and quite a diverse range of movies. I think you say it spans about 4 or 5 decades. There are some that I've never seen. Mm-hmm. Some of those Hammer horrors are very hard to get. How did you come across some of those copies?
Well, I think there's only one Hammer film in this season because, as you say, they're rare.
Yes.
Frankenstein Must Be Destroyed there was actually a print available domestically here in Australia.
Oh, wow.
And it was in relatively good condition. You know, a few little scratches at the reel changes, which is where you, you know, films most likely show signs of age. But I kind of like that because, you know, you're watching a 35mm print rather than some other format. So that was available, and it, of the Frankenstein series, it's probably my favourite. Terence Fisher really goes all out. He's absolutely demented by the time we get to... I think this was the fourth in the Frankenstein series that Hammer Productions made in the 60s and early 70s. And it just has a lot of juice, you know? So we were very happy. That was a nice coincidence of not having to look too far afield. Of course, a lot of the other films in the season have come from producers and studios overseas. So, for example, we were very, very lucky to track down the a producer that Mario Bava had worked with for a few decades.
Wow.
And he has made...
It was.
He has made... there were a few rights issues with Mario Bava's films in recent years, but they were finally all sorted. And so the producer has made beautiful new 35mm prints available.
Wow.
So we have both Black Sunday and Baron Blood. Black Sunday is very much a film that Burton quotes as one of the influences in films, again, like Sleepy Hollow, and but also just generally in terms of the kind of... Mario Bava wasn't into splatter. He was into mood and atmosphere. And, of course, Barbara Steele became very famous with her appearance in Black Sunday.
Yeah, haunting.
They are, and just that bone structure too.
I know.
Joy, 94.9.
With Tim Burton, where he just says, you know, he grew up in an era where there were lots of repertory cinemas in the neighbourhood where he lived in Burbank, which was just, you know, sort of suburban Los Angeles. And so he kind of had his pick of these sorts of films in repertory cinemas, which I guess, you know, with the advent of DVD and Blu-ray, is you can still have that experience, but you have it at home isolated or with one or two friends, whereas, you know, in that period you actually had a collective experience in a cinema.
And they're probably all nice and clean versions, you know, digitalized and, you know, Dolby-ized and so forth. I remember seeing Jason and the Argonauts just on TV when I was a kid, just being amazed by the stop motion.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, that's probably been quite influential on him, I'd say.
Oh, absolutely. Ray Harryhausen, again, is a figure that Burton quotes. You know, it doesn't take a lot of reading on Tim Burton to have Ray Harryhausen's name pop up. And Burton is clearly an aficionado of stop-motion animation and would probably do more of it if he had the time and the studio was prepared to put up the money. But, of course, he contributed... he was a co-creator of Corpse Bride. He co-directed that. And The Nightmare Before Christmas was a real passion project for Burton that took him years to realise. And
he co-produced, or he was involved with... Nine, wasn't he?
Yes, he was in a sort of producer capacity, and also with Henry Selick's James and the Giant Peach. So, stop motion animation is very close to Tim Burton's artistic heart. So, Jason and the Argonauts. I actually remember just recently rereading something where he talked about going to see that at an Art Deco theatre called the Avalon on Catalina Island. So it was, you know, a trip over the water to get to Catalina Island, and that was the first time he'd seen Jason and the Argonauts, and so that's a pretty vivid, specific memory to have.
I can imagine he can probably remember the hot dog he had. I wouldn't be surprised.
What condiment did you have with that hot dog,
Tim? What was the hot dog doing? It's probably animated.
But yeah, no, you're right. The stop motion animation in that is just kind of so breathtaking, really. Those skeletons, you know, I mean, I was totally freaked when I saw those skeletons.
Call Joy. 1-300-JOY-949.
He loved seeing The Tomb of Ligeia, which is one of the Roger Corman directed features we've included, in which Vincent Price stars. And again, Vincent Price was a hero of Tim Burton's, and so we've made sure to include a couple of Vincent Price films. The other one is The Pit and the Pendulum, also an Edgar Allan Poe adaptation. But that is a wonderful film, and we were lucky to get it again. Joe Dante gave us permission to screen his personal copy, and so it's coming over from Los Angeles. So that's
fantastic. Yeah. What a score.
So I think that's probably a up there for me. But, you know, I recently rewatched Forbidden Planet and fell in love with it all over again. I hadn't seen Bela Lugosi, the classic Universal Dracula from 1931 for a few years and was just struck by just...
It is amazing.
..how atmospheric and how wonderful his performance is, you know?
It's very silent era, even though it's just on that cusp.
It is on the cusp,
and
right.
I believe I was looking at some special features. This is the DVD I was watching, and there was actually a Spanish horror version of Dracula made at the same time, and they shared the sets.
That's right, because they have such a huge Latino population that Universal Studios were canny enough to say, well, while we're at it, we'll make a Spanish-language version for the Mexican, you know, kind of
Hispanic population.
Mm. And they very cannily did. But the DOP on that Dracula, the 1931, Karl Freund, I think his name is, mm-hmm. was a recent emigre from Germany. So he was he was well-founded in German expressionism and brought all of that to the making of Todd Browning's feature.
Which leads on nicely to the Nosferatu copy you've got, A Symphony of Horror, the F.W. Murnau.
Yep.
One.
And that sort of ties in nicely. I mean, it's in there to sort of just give people a little sampler of your classic kind of German expressionist style, which you see in the production design of, you know, different Burton films from and just those, you know, the skewed angles and jagged lines. So anything from Frankenweenie, his 29 minute short film.
Tell us about that one, Frankenweenie. It's quite rare, is that right?
Yeah, well...
To view?
It was for a long time because he was able to make that while he was still working at Disney. He sort of had a problematic relationship with Disney in that he didn't really fit the Disney style. But
Can't imagine he would have.
But he was lucky that they actually gave him a little bit of room, and he had a couple of champions at Disney who realised he wasn't Disney fodder, but that he had talent.
Okay.
And they actually financed both his very first short film, Vincent, which is narrated by Vincent Price.
Excellent.
And that's a stop-motion animation. Mm. And then a few years later, they financed this almost half-hour long-form short film, which is live-action about a gorgeous little boy, Victor, whose beloved dog Sparky dies. Mm. And Victor figures, well, maybe he can reanimate him.
Bring Sparky back. Why not? Give it
a go. And Shelley Duvall and Daniel Stern play the parents.
Oh,
and
excellent.
It's in glorious black and white. Mm. And it's 19... I think he made that in 1984. But you look at that and it's just all there, you know? Like, you can recognise so many signature elements that we now just, you know, recognise instantly
as
Tim Burton.
Joy 94.9, gay radio, good times. Good times.
Mars Attacks is, very much a favourite of mine.
Mm-hmm.
And The Corpse Bride, didn't get a huge release, but I thought it was a brilliant film.
Yeah, it's one of my favourites, Corpse Bride.
As well.
Yeah.
And Sweeney Todd, which I didn't like the first time I saw it. I actually got a headache. I think it was the production values and just the monochromaticness. It was actually quite overwhelming for the senses.
Yep.
But it might be better on a small screen. I don't know, because I enjoyed it the second time and
I think it's in
it at home.
Cinema 2. We'll be in Cinema 2, which is our largest cinema. So it'll be a reasonable size and sound.
I'm glad it's not in 3D.
No.
No. And, of course, the latest one, which is Alice in Wonderland.
Alice in Wonderland, yeah.
Excellent.
Where he just had to set stop motion aside for a little bit and explore, you know, computer-generated imagery.
Certainly has been.
More.
And pushing it, I think. Similar to Avatar, but perhaps pushing it even further. My opinion anyway. So what are the dates again?
Okay,
just to cover?
So Monsters, Ghouls and Melancholy Misfits, the film season, will kick off on Friday the 9th of July, and that will run until the 18th of July. The film retrospective will kick off on Friday the 25th of June with Pee-wee's Big Adventure. Tim Burton's actually going to introduce that night's opening screening.
Excellent.
And then all of the other films will screen over the 14 weeks of the exhibition, so up to October 10.
Fantastic. And what happens next? Are these films being taken around Australia, or is this it?
No. The exhibition is an an Australian exclusive at Acme. Mm. And we haven't explored the option of a touring program. I guess Melbourne's just a bit lucky to have Acme all to itself.
Exactly. If we could clone it, we would. Well, that's excellent. And so you're obviously a horror genre fan yourself. Is this a passion, or
It's sort of becoming a passion. I wouldn't have thought so a few years ago, but we had a season of Asia and Dario Argento films at Acme about two or three years ago now. And I must admit, I got into Argento films for the first time in a very real way, to the point where at one stage I kind of complained that I saw a Dario Argento film that didn't have enough blood and gore in it. So we screened Tenebrae, I remember, and I just remember finally kind of getting it. So I think more and more I'm prepared to go there. I'm not too good with out and out modern splatter or torture porn.
Yeah. No.
Must say. There's a lot of dimensions to horror.
Certainly is. Well, all I can say is thanks so much for coming into the studio for tonight's episode of Sci-Fi and Squeam. I really appreciate the time that you've taken to talk to us.
Thank you, Sonia. It's been my pleasure.
Thank you, Roberta. And that's Roberta Ciabatta, the curator of Monsters, Ghouls and Melancholy Misfits. Plus, she's involved with the Tim Burton film retrospective that's on at Acme for this winter, which was excellent. And, I'm looking forward to seeing some of those films again and again. You've been listening to Sonia on Sci-Fi and Squeam on Joy 94.9, and that's Australia's only LGBTIQ sci-fi and horror radio show on Joy 94.9. Thanks for listening. That was the interview with Roberta Ciabatta from Acme about, the films Under Monsters, Ghouls and Melancholy Misfits.
Yeah, it's really interesting to hear about Tim Burton's influences. If you go to the exhibition at Acme, you'll be able to see a lot of his drawings and illustrations, some model work from his early times. Sometimes some of it was from when he was at Disney. A lot of it's just from his brain. It seems to pop out no matter where he is, but clearly influenced by a lot of those films. Mm. And you mentioned Jason and the Argonauts, which I think some people may not know it, but once they see that scene with the skeletons, I'm sure they'll recognise it.
And their nightmares, probably.
Possibly.
Somewhere in there. Yeah, so it's been great to bring to you in the last couple of episodes the lowdown on Tim Burton and on the exhibition in particular. We were very lucky that Acme was kind enough to support us on that one, and they also provided the prizes for the show. And we've tried to do it justice as much as possible with some of the recordings. It wasn't easy.
It was a little bit tough. You'll see for yourself, if you get down to the exhibition, the ambience, they've got some music from Tim Burton films playing in the background. There's a lot of sort of bits and pieces, so there's a lot of things for noise to sort of jump off, but it's a really great place to be, and I'm sure it's going to be packed. So try and get down there. It is running till October, but make sure you get in because I'm sure you're going to want to go more than once.
I would like to. I think
absolutely.
I will.
It also sounds like a fabulous place to work, actually. We've spoken to Jenny Hay from MoMA, who was collaborating with Acme. We also spoke to Roberta Ciabatta. It's one of those things, curating an exhibition like that would be a fabulous job.
And you get to travel.
You get to travel. You get to meet Tim Burton.
Exotic places like Melbourne.
Well, that's right. And Melbourne is apparently officially renamed Melbourne.
Until October.
So tell everyone where you're from. Mm. This is Sci-Fi and Squeam, Melbourne's only gay and lesbian sci-fi and horror show on Joy 94.9.
And if you want more details of any of those things discussed tonight, you can actually head to our Facebook page, Sci-Fi and Squeam, and that'd be great. And thanks to all of you for listening tonight to the only LGBTIQ horror and sci-fi show. Now, next week, what are we going to do?
We've got quite a bit to talk about. We've almost got a sort of an embarrassment of riches, really. Mm. We're going to start easing into the new
grid. The new season for winter.
That's right. If you'd like to suggest something for us to talk about, you can always go to our Facebook page and make a suggestion. Just search for Sci-Fi and Squeam. We'd love to hear from you. We've also posted a lot of really interesting links, as Sonia mentioned. We've got some links to the Tim Burton information, but we've also got links about various films that are coming out. We've got an upcoming interview in the next season with Paul Soleil, Oscar Hillestrom from Rotten Tomatoes and Empire Magazine.
And we'll also be interviewing Charlene Harris in August sometime.
That's right. We're really looking forward to that. So hopefully
the
that creator
comes through. True Blood, of course.
That's right. Well, she wrote the Sookie Stackhouse novels, which the TV show is based on.
Mm. And up next, we've got The Frequency with tonight's theme, which is lots of Kylie Minogue with Petro Salikas. And that's on Joy 94.9. So until next week, when that day comes, I shall futter whacken vigorously. Do you know where that's from?
Jabberwocky.
Yeah. Yep. Well, actually, the Mad Hatter.
The Mad Hatter.
That's cool. I don't think Jabberwocky says much.
No, no. All. Well, the Jabberwocky doesn't
say anything. A lot of hot air.
Yeah.
Yeah. You've been listening to Sonia and Kaz on Sci-Fi and Squeam.
Sci-Fi and Squeam was synthesised and squashed into shape by Sonia, Albert and Kaz. For more information, visit our Facebook page, Sci-Fi and Squeam, or check out joy.org.au.
Thank you for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.